Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Lara Chan-Baker.
Hello.
Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the souped-up Nissan skyline that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping-off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing the inevitable Banksy shredding, learning through drawing, and the resurgence of zine culture. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our special guest, John Westenberg. John has built a career on content through his columns in Inc.com, the San Francisco Chronicle, Startup Grind, Time Online, and the New York Observer, as well as many, many other publications. Incredibly, John holds the largest Medium audience in the Asia-Pacific region, with a following of around 125,000, and one of the largest worldwide. He holds a Platinum Hermes Award for digital content and has worked as a CMO for Speedlancer, a CMO for Fishburners, and is currently the director of PR and communications for Flair and the marketing advisor to Connected Environs platform PAM. Crazy, crazy stuff. John, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. My schedule actually sounds a lot busier than it really is. I spend a lot of time reading Harry Potter fan fiction.
Because I get like deep anxiety reading your bio because holy moly. I mean, yeah, that sounds like a lot of things to do. A lot of things to do. Now, John, I'm very excited to have you here again. We were just chatting before. We had you for one of our IRL Open Tabs events in Sydney just a couple of months back, and it was awesome. And so it's very, very lovely to be able to have you here again.
It was a fun event. Yeah, good times.
Yes, absolutely. Jeremy, how are you doing?
How am I doing? I'm okay. I have to stop and think about it. I think everything's okay. I'm going to the States for like the first time in 5 years next week. So I'm kind of, you know, psyching myself up.
And you love flying, don't you, Jeremy?
I love flying. I love America. I haven't been there in a while. I hear things have changed a bit. So
the odd thing here or there.
I think so. Yeah, we'll let you know. But it should be really fun. We're heading over with our Flutter director, Dom and Bianca. So we're going to have, and I'm just kind of taking the last 5 years and kind of everything that I've kind of wanted to do and just kind of really trying to fit it in this like small, like little window.
Number one thing, what are you going to do?
Well, renting a Dodge Challenger as our rental car
to
go completely ham while we're on the road, which is the most impractical kind of like meeting and work car.
Nah, that's awesome.
I got that in the car. Speaking of Harry Potter fan fiction, definitely going to the new Harry Potter world and going to try some of that butterbeer. And got some tickets booked for the Kings versus Rangers at the Staples Center.
You are like a child, but I'm excited for you.
So excited. Obviously, I'm going for
it's
work,
like
though.
Every 10-year-old asks for his birthday.
Pretty much. So let's dive into our first link of the week.
Yes.
It was inevitable that we were going to discuss this in some form or another. So Lara, take us away.
Yeah, look, the Banksy shredding. As you said, I figured.
The guitar solo.
Yeah, the guitar solo. Yeah, the shredding of his artwork. I mean, look, I figured this was going to come up in conversation at some point, so I thought I may as well get it started. First, just a little bit of a recap for anyone living under a rock or in some kind of utopia where social media doesn't exist. On October 5th, Sotheby's auctioned off a painting called Girl with Balloon by the street artist Banksy, and the painting was a scaled-down version of a large mural he's done in a few places, titled Balloon Girl. Originally, it was sprayed onto a wall in East London in like 2002. And so what happened is that a split second after the gavel dropped and the painting sold to a bidder for $1.4 million, the artwork...
Dollars or pounds?
No, the pounds amount was different. I think $1.4 million.
Yep.
The artwork suddenly dropped through the frame and came out the other side in shreds. And the moment itself, which was accompanied by a very loud beeping alarm, it was captured on video and immediately went viral. And if you haven't watched it, I do suggest that you take a look at the sort of various faces of shock of all the fancy people gathered at Sotheby's, just sort of mouths gaping at what had happened. And then the following day via Instagram, Banksy released his own short video showing him, or at least someone in his sort of signature hoodie getup, mounting a shredder inside the painting frame and sort of briefly explaining the operation. The idea being that he had built this in some years ago, hatching this plan to sort of destroy, and I say that very much with inverted commas, to destroy the artwork if it were ever to be sold. And he deleted the clip pretty much immediately, but in true internet nature, copies very promptly began to circulate the World Wide Web. And so here we are. It's about a week later now at time of recording. And the incident has led to a lot of speculation and millions of think pieces, one of which I've brought here for us today. So this this particular piece comes from arts writer and activist Jennifer Rabin, and it was posted to her Medium blog with the title, "Banksy Didn't Shred His Painting, The Art Market Did." And it centers on the argument that the art world have an inability or a willful refusal to see past an object to the attention behind it, and therefore sort of they completely miss the point with this stunt. And she argues, in her words, "The painting wasn't destroyed. The irreplaceable pieces of contemporary art in Charles Saatchi's collection that perished in a 2006 warehouse fire, those were destroyed. What happened at Sotheby's to Girl with Balloon was that a conceptual artist transformed his own piece of art and did so as a premeditated response to the actions of an exploitative art market." So look, there's so much that I have to say on this and a lot of things that I want to dive into. But first, John, I want to know, was this also just all bloody over your socials last week?
It was. I couldn't take a shit without seeing something about Banksy. And personally, I absolutely can't stand Banksy. I never have been able to stand his work. It's just, you know, it's like a great big painting of a fat Ronald McDonald saying capitalism is bad. You know, it's so incredibly obvious. It's the Lincoln Park of pop culture art, and it's the Nickelback of political expressions. Basically, this
coffee table book. That is quite the critique.
Throw Norma to a straight couple on the divorce track.
There's our podcast title right there.
100%.
Okay.
John, that is, I'm sure you are with many, many people in how you feel about Banksy.
And I guess it just feels quite cheap. I mean, the entire stunt to me just felt cheap. Like, of course, who's going to shred a painting? And of course, everyone's going to lose their shit. And all these people are going to use their top of the range iPhones to tweet about how he was showing the true face of capitalism, all this kind of stuff. And it kind of just felt like everyone was falling into a piece of performance art where the performance art wasn't actually shredding the painting. It was showing that everyone has very little individualism or very little ability to think for themselves because they're all so easily impressed by just destroying something.
I absolutely agree that that was the sort of the real stunt there, was that sort of play on the reaction of the art market. Jeremy, what about you? I mean, the piece makes this argument that the stunt was a statement to the art world about the value of art and the insanity of the art market. And do you think that's true? Do you think it achieved that?
Oh, I don't know. I think, you know, the genius and non-genius in this whole thing is like, you cannot come at this piece in any real way. I don't know, like without kind of like every single point that you can make for, it creates a point against it and kind of vice versa. I mean,
yeah, commenting on it at all makes you a part of the...
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, this article in particular, I find to be quite shallow. The headline as well, it's like makes me feel like the real Banksy's in the painting. It's the friends we made along the way. You know, it kind of like has that whole kind of thing on it. And I don't know. Every time I read something about Banksy, I'll just kind of go like my one and only Banksy story is, I think it was in 2003 when the first semi-permanent was happening. They got Banksy out to be part of the show. And like basically... there was like a gift shop for semi-permanent, like, and there were posters of like all the artists kind of going there and everything, and there were just like Banksy posters of this exact piece like in there, like for sale for like $60, you know.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh fuck, I need to have Hungry Jack's tonight for dinner because that's all I could afford. And I couldn't afford like buying this
how
poster.
How times have changed, Jeremy.
I really
now
want
you sit in your castle.
But I would love to know if anyone, thousands of people listen to this podcast, surely somebody else was at that semi-permanent. If you were anyone you know bought one of those Banksy's, I would love to know who did and what became of them. Anyway, that's my only kind of real response there on a personal one. But like, I don't know, like I have it's like, you know, the shredding of the work, it's interesting to have the conversation. It's interesting that this piece kind of brought up like, well, actually you've missed the point. It's kind of bringing attention to these political issues that he wanted you to actually kind of talk about. And it's like, well, now the piece is even more expensive and even more valuable.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, I feel like, well, maybe it's Banksy's responsibility here to actually kind of state what his intentions were.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like that's kind of like just putting it all back on the art market and putting it all back on the audience is making us draw on these conclusions and absolving the artist of any kind of responsibility. And so I would love to hear more from him about this.
Yeah, totally. I mean, this piece, I agree, was like quite shallow, but it led me down an interesting path that I actually wasn't super aware of. I guess I'll start here. Like, you know, in the piece, the writer sort of analyzes Banksy's motives as you know, many have done in the weeks following. And to read from the piece again, she says, "This was not a publicity stunt, as some art world insiders have suggested. It was simply the restating of a message that the artist has repeated to us over and over again, and which the art world refuses to ignore. I mean, continues to ignore." Banksy made his position clear in 2006, lamenting the trend of money-hungry gallerists and collectors who steal works of street art from the public sphere in order to personally profit from them on the secondary art market. And the Banksy quote that she's referring to is one in which he stated some time ago, in his words again, "Graffiti art has a hard enough life as it is before you add hedge fund managers wanting to chop it out and hang it over the fireplace. For the sake of keeping all street art where it belongs, I'd encourage people not to buy anything by anybody unless it was created for sale in the first place." So I think at this point, it's important to note the significance of this particular artwork as it relates to a group called Sinkura Arts. Have you heard of Sinkura Arts?
No, what is it?
I have not, no.
Yeah, they're actually a concierge service, but they also claim to be the leading expert on Banksy pieces, and they've become really well known for actually physically removing Banksy murals from walls, like actually cutting the section off and keeping the artwork intact and restoring them on behalf of the property owner and then selling them. So in 2014, they held an exhibition called Stealing Banksy, which supposedly showcased the most expensive collection of Banksy artworks ever assembled, and it included Balloon Girl. And at the time, Banksy very publicly blasted the group, saying that it was organized without any involvement or consent from him, and that he thought it was disgusting that people were allowed to go displaying art on walls without getting permission from the artists. And whether or not he was in on it, who knows? There's lots of speculation. But the same group, Sinkura Arts, they're now releasing a book that they claim includes two photos of the artist with his sort of paintbrush in hand, painting one of his most famous murals. And this is really controversial because Banksy's whole thing is that his identity is hidden from the world. And of course, he's, you know, completely slammed this invasion of his privacy again. So all of this in mind, I think Jennifer's overall argument is that it's the art market, not really Banksy himself, that shredded this piece because of their ignorance of Banksy's sort of anti-commodification intentions. And I think despite any feelings about him, you don't have to look too far. We can't go into all of it, but if you take a very brief look at the history of his pieces, it's more than clear that his work is often critiquing their own sort of commodification and increasingly the public's attitudes towards art and the value of art. And even if you don't feel positively about Banksy, I definitely still suggest spending an arvo looking at some of his works, because there's some interesting sort of incredibly tangled critique in there that's quite fascinating. And of course, I think it's funny now that everyone's asking questions around whether Sotheby's were involved or if perhaps even like the seller and buyer were in on it too. But I mean, I guess it's probably besides the point. I think Banksy's in this really unique position that only artists of a certain status are in, where anything he creates is immediately worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more. And I think he probably finds it quite hilarious himself that the piece that we're talking about here is a simple stencil that could essentially be easily replicated. And I think he very clearly knew all along what effect the stunt would have on the value of his work, which, you know, as we said, for the record, most valuers agree now that it's worth significantly more than what the bidder paid for it. And I think the whole thing is a bit of a study in how virality sort of affects value. I don't know. I mean, I just look back to a piece of his that was several years ago. It was also auctioned at Sotheby's, and it was just a framed painting of the words, "I can't believe you morons actually buy this shit." And I think, I don't know, whatever you think, I mean, he is sort of testing the boundaries to see if the art world will ever stop paying for his ridiculousness. And I don't know if he would care if they did. He might even be happy if they did.
The entire idea of owning art is quite problematic to begin with. You know, why does it matter to these people so much that they have to actually be able to point at a piece of creative work and say, "That is mine," and put their name to something that already bears the artist's name, the artist's intent? And I think the real problem with art today and with a lot of creativity is that it's not that it's commercialized, it's not that it's commoditized, it's that we have this obsession with being able to say that we own rather than we appreciate.
I think that's a really valid point.
Yeah, I mean, and it also goes back into what we were talking about a few weeks ago, I guess, in terms of how you sell kind of conceptual art as well, because this piece is now a piece of conceptual art as well, like in addition to the actual kind of piece. So look, it's the definite, it's spawned many, many think pieces. And I think,
and within the next week, it'll have blown over completely. There'll be another thing.
On to the next thing, but definitely worthwhile having discussion. And I think we'll move on from there. The second link of the week is from yours truly, again from my dad, who just happens to be a great source.
Man, he should start a newsletter. I'd sign up.
He really should.
Or a podcast.
Yeah.
My dad is really onto it. I hope he's listening to it. He always gets me into the coolest stuff. My dad was like into Radiohead like when I was like 13 or 14. It's like, you know,
that's pretty cool.
You gotta listen to this like song called Fitter Happier. I was like, holy shit.
Dad and I just bought tickets to Cool and the Gang this morning.
See? cultural differences. Anyway, this is a piece from Quartz, and it goes, "The best way to learn is by drawing." So Ann Keita writes this piece in Quartz, which is a review of a new book by D.B. Dowd called Stick Figures. drawing as human practice. And he basically argues that putting a pencil to paper shouldn't be about making art at all, but that most people turn away from it once you realize that our draftsmanship skills aren't up to par. But we're obviously seeing a huge resurgence here. And I'm sure that kind of tablet culture, things like people, you know, drawing on Instagram, drawing on stories, on Snapchat stories, et cetera, it's a huge part of, I guess, this increase in us drawing and making kind of marks in this way, which is a very kind of primitive thing. If you've been to art school or kind of done any art history class, the first thing that they always show is those cave paintings, you know, people kind of making marks as a way of expressing themselves. And I've always found that life drawing is always such an interesting thing as well. We do it here in our gallery as well, but it was always one of my favorite things to do. And I loved at the end of it doing the crits and kind of just seeing how 20 different people can interpret the same thing. It's just such an amazing representation of subjective reality. And I think also from an illustrative perspective, we're seeing a huge insurgence in scribing and visual recording. And so this, you know, a whole industry kind of springing up around visual thinkers and people who use drawing as a way to kind of work through complex ideas and a way to kind of represent these types of things as well. He further goes on to say in the review of the book that at its core, drawing is a problem-solving tool and that digital technology coddles us by giving us shortcuts to instant knowledge, but drawing breaks our collective instinct to Google. I didn't really understand this argument. It's like, if I want to see who a celebrity's wife is, I'm going to probably Google that first rather than trying to kind of draw it out. But one of the main points he makes here is that drawing makes us slow down, be patient, and pay attention. And he says, observation itself is respectful above all else. And this is where he kind of goes on to conclude, I guess, one of the more radical points, which I found was the most interesting, but it says, it might seem sort of nutty, but I do think that drawing can be sort of a form of citizenship. Observation, inquiry, and steady effort are good for us, and that this form of individual sense-making is a practice that's ever more vital in today's times. When you look hard and listen carefully, how are we not led back to questions of justice, of what is right? So pretty deep, a pretty deep connection to make the drawing. But I think if you kind of look at, and again, other trends, not kind of even on a consumer level, like coloring books, for example, and how that's been such a big thing. I think there's part of kind of mindfulness that's, you know, the whole mindfulness movement kind of baked into that. But I think that there's still a lot of kind of constraints in there. And I think doing free drawing is a real kind of act of, it's an extreme act, like to actually kind of sit down and kind of say you're going to kind of draw something, or even just the kind of free draw itself. It requires getting a huge kind of sense of confidence and kind of going beyond kind of what your comfort is. But I think what this piece is kind of proposing, what is kind of interesting about it, that it is a worthwhile pursuit to make. And obviously in the illustration industry, that kind of forms the whole backbone of the talents that we represent, what we do. So look, I wanted to turn first to you, John, because I'm really curious to hear your takeaway on this, because learning is a huge part of your practice. You have, as we've mentioned, 125,000 people who are looking to learn from you, no pressure at all, but specifically through your written word or type word. So does drawing have or hasn't had any kind of impact on your practice? And if not, did this piece inspire you to maybe try at all?
That's quite an interesting kind of question. Yeah, it does speak to like a deeper understanding of what it means to create a mark or a symbol and to leave that mark or symbol open to interpretation. I guess what I would say is this, like I would question whether it's valuable to think of making that mark, making that drawing as being a tool in any way, like a tool to learn or a tool to improve, because to some extent that removes the meaning of that mark on its own, like as a standalone exercise of creativity or a standalone exercise of interpretation of your particular world, of your paradigm. And I guess if you do say, okay, I'm going to draw because it can help me learn, I'm going to draw because it's going to help me to improve as a person, you are stripping away what it means to draw, because, you know, sometimes to draw can just be to draw. Sometimes it can be to express a meaning of your own. It doesn't necessarily have to have a productive use. And so for me, I guess like there is danger in always feeling that we have to be productive or that we have to assign value to an exercise by ensuring that it is productive in some way. I think that's quite dangerous.
I think in some ways, though, that can encourage, because there's people who have a natural inclination to draw and there's people who don't, and perhaps attaching some kind of potential benefit to it might encourage other types to pick up a pencil and have a stab. I don't know. I mean, Jeremy, what about you? What do you think?
I think there's always going to be a certain element in terms of these articles as well, like in these think pieces, like everything's so much about self-improvement in so many kind of different ways. And I think that's been a really hard thing about this podcast in some ways, that every time we get to something, it's like always like, oh, another self-improvement thing. Like, yeah. And I kind of see John's point, like, you know, why can't we just kind of draw for pleasure? Or why can't it be this kind of pure expression? I think what's interesting, though, is that it's actually kind of the inverse. It is actually this kind of, I think when a lot of us draw, we realize we're not amazing drawers because we're seeing so much content and so much amazing illustration, amazing artwork out there. So I think in some ways this piece has a bit of is saying a bit of an opposite thing, and maybe it's trying to use that leverage of self-improvement to try to get somebody out of their ordinary mindset of thinking they're not good enough to maybe make those connections. I don't know. I mean, that could be a pretty abstract takeaway there, but maybe to go a bit more abstract, John, in terms of how drawings and learning kind of intersect. I mean, illustration itself, like, or illustrators especially, they're kind of considered to be, well, in an editorial sense, sometimes co-authors of a piece. It's like, so, you know, an author has kind of a piece that they're trying to express kind of their perspective or express kind of a certain complex series of ideas. And they use illustrations as a way to accompany that text, as a way to kind of further that message. And one thing I've noticed kind of looking through a lot of your Medium writings, especially, is that it's very devoid of any kind of illustration or imagery in that way. And I was just wondering, is that something kind of deliberate, or, you know, what role does kind of imagery play in your own professional practice?
I mean, I'm a very visual person. Aesthetics are very important to me. Fashion is very important to me. The way things look can keep me up at night. But what I really want to do when I write is often just divorce any kind of imagery from the written word. And like, I haven't always done this. Certainly when I first started blogging, I threw in as many pictures as I could, and I wanted to make things visually exciting and attractive and all these things. And for me, that was just kind of distracting from what I was actually trying to do, which was just to express myself through the older technology we have, you know, which is the written word. And it's not that I have any kind of real ethical objection to having illustrations in my work at all. I mean, I keep a journal every single day that I write in that is just for me. And every single time I write in it, I add a hand-drawn picture that sums up what I'm doing while I'm writing that entry. I really enjoy that, and it does help to remember, I guess, moments in my life. But when I put work out into the world, sometimes it's extremely visual. Sometimes when I publish a zine, which I do publish, called Adrift, I like to include some visuals in that, and it could be like just a picture of a Game Boy to represent some part of my childhood that I want people to resonate with. And so, like, in that context, yeah, I'll use a lot of imagery. But for my blog itself, the entire purpose is to provide an alternative to the big pivot to video and pivot to images and so on that everyone else does online, and just to really focus on the fact that you can express much more in pure text than you ever can in a picture. You know, people like to say a picture says 1,000 words, and I think, yeah, it does, but it often says the wrong ones, and there's something really beautiful about saying the right ones.
Laura, I'm sure you have a lot to say in response to that, but I want to kind of draw attention to one of your infamous self-portrait drawings
that
appeared in, I think, your cover letter or CV when you applied for our job many years ago. God. I will forever hold that on as blackmail. But you always have said that kind of drawing plays a special part in your upbringing. We've talked about your dad and the drawings that he's done. And if you want to look back at our Instagram, you could see a fine example of that. And, you know, from, again, like, life drawing is something that I kind of really relish myself. But, you know, now, again, I'm surrounded by such amazing artists every day. I feel really quite self-conscious as well, like, kind of drawing for pleasure. But I notice everyone here kind of at the office, like, there's always a pen and paper on everyone's desk. And I'm just kind of curious, how did this resonate with you? Like, you know, do you draw kind of as part of your role here or kind of in your life? Where is that kind of intersection?
Yeah, I mean, look, firstly, I can't believe you brought up that bloody portrait. I was so proud of that. I taught myself how to use Illustrator from free online tutorials, and I did it all myself, but I can't actually believe that I included it in my cover letter. It's fucking embarrassing. But yeah, look, I mean, I'm definitely more verbal than I am visual. I have a deep appreciation for the visual, but in terms of how I learn and how I think, it's like in my brain. You know, I'm always amazed by people that have a really like visual thought system, you know, like really, I really struggle to like picture things in my head, but everything I think incredibly just inwards all the time. Like, that said though, like, I was a pretty avid drawer in my childhood, and even more so in my teen years. I wanted to be an illustrator for a long time. I got really, really into it. But I think then as the article notes, I probably did hit a point where I was self-conscious of my skills or lack thereof, you know, partly from comments like yours, Jeremy, laughing at me for my self-portrait. I also just never really had the patience to get better at it. Like, I'm just not very good at sitting still for that long. I do find drawing really hard. I've got a truly terrible memory, and it's pretty much impossible for me to draw anything remotely realistic without reference imagery. So I just don't find it that fun. And that said though, like, being surrounded by so many incredible, very skilled artists every day for the last 5 years and more just being in the sort of ad industry before that, there are many times over the last few years and even in the last few months, even in the last week, that I've felt super compelled to try painting, not so much drawing. And I don't know, for some reason, I feel like it's more accepted for a painting to be quite abstract and blobby, more so than a drawing, you know, and it feels more physical and more different to anything else that I do in my day to day. But still, you know, I think every time that urge hits me, I always end up considering like the cost of the paints and the canvases and sort of figure that it's a pretty expensive thing to do if you're not any good at it. And I'm like a child. I get really disappointed when I'm not good at something. I don't like doing it. And particularly with art, I do get very self-conscious about it precisely because I am surrounded by so many mega talented people. It does make it hard to even want to start. And even if I did, I can sort of guarantee that I'd never show anyone what I'd made, especially you, Jeremy, maybe my dog. But one thing I have been doing more of though, and John, this sort of reminds me of what you were just saying, is just sort of casual, no purpose writing. Yeah, I'm definitely more of a writer than I am an artist. And just, you know, carrying a notebook with me and when I'm on the train or sitting in bed, just trying to write without too much sort of self-criticism or without any particular goal. And that's probably when, you know, in reading this article, I recognize that that's probably my form of drawing in the sense that it's my way of sort of looking closely at my surroundings and connecting with the details. As, you know, the guy in the article says, drawing is great for. And it's always really hard to start. But once I'm in the flow of it, I really do get a lot out of it. And I feel great for a while afterwards. It's almost like I get endorphins from it, you know. But yeah, I definitely think there is something in that idea of disconnecting from not just from your devices and from the internet, but also just from, I don't know, your thoughts and the general flow of the day to day and looking at because I was riding on the tram the other day and I was like looking at the people around me and just jotting down little things and I don't know, the condition of the seating and whatever, random things that I would just never pay any attention to. And perhaps it's not important if I never pay attention to them, but it felt really nice to just sort of center yourself in that space and time, and writing or drawing can be a really nice way of doing that. And so I've really been getting along out of that. But yeah, back to visual arts for a second though. I do wish that there wasn't such an emphasis in school that art needs to be realistic, like especially with drawing. I think almost all of my favorite artists today are people who draw and paint with a kind of like childlike looseness that I find really pleasing. So I feel sad that like one of the reasons I stopped drawing was because I felt like I couldn't draw something that looked real.
Interesting. I mean, I haven't come across that. And, you know, my kids are kind of, well, my oldest is kind of turning 5, and it's amazing to see, you know, how she has kind of taught herself kind of drawing as well. And like she sees things in her drawings that we don't kind of see, and like develop her own kind of visual language in that way.
Totally. I've got a 12-year-old sister and she just like, she's autistic and drawing has become such an outlet for her. And she does these crazy like storyboards of like all these, like with these different like camera angles, all these characters. And like, I don't know where they get it from, but it's that lack of self-consciousness, I think, that you have at that age. It really allows you to. Well, I think there's certain things that you wouldn't do now.
Yeah, I think there's something though that I'm seeing, like especially when you look at kind of Instagram comic artists as such, like, you know, people who just have great ideas for jokes or humor that don't necessarily have that drawing ability, and it doesn't make the work any less fun. And if anything, it's super on trend at the moment.
But then you have to have humor. Like, so what if you don't have humor and you're just trying to create something that's aesthetically nice?
I think that's tricky. And I think that's where like a lot of the software and hardware companies have some kind of like responsibility as well, because everything it's like, you want to talk about unrealistic beauty standards, like look at any, like, you know, Procreate and Apple, like companies I love, like, but like, you know, it's all just about like this amazing kind of finished product that's kind of made for artists. Like, I have to wonder, like, how many artists are actually kind of out there that can do something to this kind of level? So it's like, yeah, what is there has to be another approach that needs to be kind of put out there as kind of just something
a little happy
it's
medium.
Okay.
I mean, it comes down to like the question of is a cave painting good or bad art? And the cave painting expressed something it was supposed to express, a mammoth or a hunt or something like that, and that was perfectly acceptable. And like, can we say that it was bad art now, thousands of years later, just because it doesn't meet the standard of realism that we started to reach towards?
Super on trend though at the moment.
Cave style art.
Yeah, cave style
art. You're not wrong.
Look at the MailChimp rebrand. It's like, you know, that could go right. Oh shit, we should have talked about that. Okay, well, maybe John, that could be your thumbs down for this week. We'll come back to that. Before we move on to the next link, I just want to do a really kind of quick roundtable here. Everyone usually has something they return to again and again when they're kind of drawing idly, like on a meeting or on a call. Like, what is the word, like the stylized S? Isn't there a special word for it?
There must be. Like,
you know what I'm talking about? The three lines.
Oh yeah, you do the three lines, and then three lines. You connect them, and yeah, absolutely.
Do you have,
it's in Wikipedia as cool S.
Cool S. Sick. John, you were saying before, you know, you do a drawing every day in your journal. Is there something that you see kind of that you come back to at all? Like a little doodle or anything particular?
I tend to draw a lot of coffee cups because I mostly write while I'm drinking coffee. But I also, like, for as long as I can remember, I've had an obsession with drawing tiny doodled self-portraits of my, or just my face, just to look at and try to identify with pictures of myself. And like, I've been doing that for as long as I can ever remember. That's been something that I constantly doodle.
And have you gotten better at it? Like, has that, doing that constantly, have they gotten better?
No, not at all.
I find that quite reassuring, to be honest.
Laura, what about you? What's your default doodle?
I find it so funny that you mentioned the cool S, because just this morning I was at the gym and Dan was like spray painting some equipment or something, right? But he had this big like panel that he'd put out so that spray paint wouldn't get anywhere. And he was like, oh, do you want to graph this panel? And I was like, yeah, I do. And I grabbed the spray paint and I was like, what am I going to graph? And the first thing that came to mind was the cool S. I've got a picture of it. We'll add it to the links, but I did the cool S. And then I tried to do a drawing of Jesse, our dog. And then I tagged my name on the side as well. And I just like, that was it. That was all that came to mind. It was like S dog. But yeah, no, I definitely scratched that S into a few school desks.
I think that's a cool thing though. It's like when you do it for the first time, it's like magic, because it empowers you to feel like you can actually draw something.
I honestly remember, this sounds so stupid, but I remember as a really young kid, like probably dad taught me like how to do like a cube, like we draw the two squares and then you connect it. And I remember thinking like, yeah, I am the best drawer. And also he bought me lots of like how to draw cartoons books. And a lot of it was like really simple shapes and stuff. And once, and it just felt so like, I just felt like the best fucking drawer ever. I have this picture of a whale that I drew that I thought was, like, I remember being so proud, not just proud, like I was like, this is a masterpiece. Mm. I spent so long on it. And then someone, my mum found it like recently. I haven't seen it for like 15, 20 years. And it's so shit. But at the time I was like, I was so genuinely in awe of like, how did I do this? But yeah, I mean, I doodle constantly in meetings, as you must know, Jeremy. As I said, I'm not really very good at sitting still, and I think it just helps keep my brain moving. Like, but I don't really draw, I tend to just draw lots of squares or line patterns, or just sort of fill in an entire page with pen rather than actually sort of actively drawing a particular thing. I think if I were to try and really draw something, then I wouldn't be paying any attention to the meeting. So for me, often drawing little patterns and things is just a way of calming restlessness, so I can listen closely. What about you, Jeremy?
I have like this weird like Venom character that I draw, but Venom like from the old, like from the original kind of when
not
it was
the current,
in
the, Tom,
not
Hardy
the current
Venom.
Tom Hardy one. Yeah. But yeah, like it's funny. It's like, I would always draw like, you know, these two eyes, like, and then the top and the bottom, but then I can't draw the rest of it. I can't draw like the neck or the body. So it's always just like this weird disembodied head anyway.
But like all through high school, I used to draw all the surf brand logos, like the Roxy, Rip Curl, Billabong logos, like over and over, like all my books. I still have some of them, I'm like coated in it. But I also would make up these little characters and I would draw them over and over and over again. But the thing was that I thought they were really good, so I was happy drawing. Now I'm just like, no, just guess I'll just draw a box.
Yeah, look, it's amazing. Like the more that we kind of talk about it, the more it's kind of bringing up a lot of these kind of sentimental feelings about like drawing, like, you know, because I think I did so much
drawing.
You can
cry here, Jeremy. It's a safe space.
Well, I feel like that because I don't know, like drawing was such a huge part like of like my kind of schooling as well. And I really wonder if people are going to get the same thing. So God damn it, I hope everyone draws before we move on to the next link. And yeah, we'll try to put some of the links to our own drawings in the show notes or in the enhanced feed as well. If you're listening to
this.
Yes, please.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And we'll go from there. John, our final link of the week is courtesy of yourself. And what I like to start out with and ask everybody who comes on the podcast, especially I'm interested in hearing from you about where you do your internet research. Are you an RSS person? Are you a newsletter person? Because this is a piece from something called studybreaks.com, which I've never heard of. So yeah, before you delve into the link, tell us a bit more about kind of your internet hygiene.
So I am a tragic Twitter user. Today is actually the 10-year anniversary of my joining Twitter, so yay me.
Oh, congratulations.
Pour one out.
To the point that my friends say I speak in conversation like I'm on Twitter, just short, sharp bursts of bullshit. And I guess that kind of resonates a lot. So mostly if I find something interesting that I love, it is either through Twitter or it is actually through a zine, because I read a lot of zines. And that's really my internet habits. Beyond Twitter and zines, I really don't actually do all that much online. Like, I'm not really an Instagram person. I don't get a lot of joy out of that. I don't like Facebook.
I don't think anyone likes Facebook at this point.
So that's where I'm at. I mean, I have a lot of paid subscriptions to things like Scribd, just actually reading books, reading online magazines and things like that. So I tend to try to stay out of the wider world of the internet as much as possible.
probably a wise decision. Where did you find this particular link, John? Tell us about it.
This was on Twitter. This was on Twitter, a link shared from a fellow zine addict.
Cool. So tell us about the link. What's the link? What did you think?
So this is an article by Christian Porter called The Resurgence of Zine Culture and Why It's So Important. And it's kind of covering off the concept of what a zine actually is, you know, independently handmade digital or physical chapbooks and collections of writing and protest work and poetry and social issues and creativity and design, all these different things that had been put together since the, I guess, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, or that entire period. And so the article is about how millennials are increasingly embracing that side of creativity rather than just doing work that's meant to live online as pictures in a gallery on some social media account. You know, they're actually dedicating themselves to creating these pamphlets. And I think it's just really interesting to see that a part of youth counterculture from way back in the Vietnam War era straight through to the resurgence of social themes around anti-war in the 80s and 90s and the development of the queer scene and the transgender scene, all these things all happen through zines, and zines are coming back again with this generation. I think it's kind of nice to see that thread being followed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so for me, like, zines have always been a really important part of who I am and what I do. They intersect with so many different interest areas of mine. When I was growing up, I was a punk, and you find punk rock through zines, the ones left at record stores and left in the clothing stores. And you can find the local bands and the shows to go to. As I started to come out with my own queer identity, I was, again, embracing zines picked up at little bookshops that talked about the fact that it was okay to be queer and gave me resources and information. And over the past, I guess, 18 months or so, I've really picked back up into the zine kind of culture. I've been going on a bit of a journey myself towards coming out as a transgender person. And this is actually probably the first time I've spoken about it publicly is right now on this podcast, which is kind of
More than welcome. Yeah. Yes.
And as a part of that, it's been reading zines and connecting with the work of other people who have gone through that journey in a way that you just can't with blog posts and tweets, because they're so public and zines are more spread through word of mouth and through trusted networks.
Do you find that, because you, as you said, you publish a zine, do you find that you talk as well about more personal topics in a zine rather than, you know, what you would on your sort of online?
Absolutely. So if I'm writing a blog post, I'll hint at various things, but I might not come out and explicitly say them so much. But if I publish a zine like a Drift, when I write an issue of that, I will literally just put down things that I wouldn't be able to say to somebody in person while making eye contact.
Well, I mean, yeah, quite an outlet. And I think that's the thing, the sense that I get from a lot of zines is that it is something that is almost created for the person themselves. And then if other people who feel similarly manage to find that content somehow, then that's wonderful. But it's not necessarily, I mean, you mentioned this in your notes as well, John, that whether it was about the making of the zine or about distributing it. And
Absolutely.
I think there's sort of, we'll talk about that in a moment. I think this piece was quite a wholesome response from someone who had never come across zines before. It was very sweet. I thought, you know, they were like, oh, look at this cool thing I discovered. And I thought that was very sweet. But they gave a really nice, breakdown of it. And it's funny, I think whilst I see zines in my periphery quite often, in particular from sort of photographer and writer friends of mine, I've never directly, completely contrasted to you, I've never directly been part of any sort of zine culture other than sort of when supporting my friends here and there. I haven't ever really sort of purchased many zines or been around people making them. So my experience of them is like quite limited and quite different to yours.
Yeah.
What about you, Jeremy?
Oh man. Yeah. I mean, zines were definitely a huge part of my upbringing. I think, yeah, you had to be kind of
were like a punk goth, weren't you?
I was a goth. Yes. That was my thing. And I mean, and this was before the, you know, really there were the kind of means to produce things independently. And I don't, there was Kinko's. Did you have Kinko's here at all?
Office Works.
But it's just like
a scan and copy shop. And just like how, like that was kind of ironically such an epicenter of subculture, because people, that's where you'd go to kind of make your zines and kind of send them out. And, you know, and even still, like some of the funniest writing and the best comics and best graphics, you know, one zine that I particularly love was Crap Hound, which was just kind of a series of clip art kind of in this way. But yeah, some of the best writing and everything was just kind of happening there. And even still, there's something amazing just about the immediacy of a zine, especially, and just making that kind of one, it feels like such a direct connection to kind of to the creator that I think that's just a strength of print in general, but I think even more so kind of with zines. And it's not surprising kind of talking about the rise of the email newsletter as well. Like people kind of want, I guess, something a bit more kind of comprehensive and a bit more kind of personal that this would kind of, this kind of resurgence kind of would happen. And I kind of think that you could see as well, like in some ways, like zines are kind of emerging and kind of rising up, and magazines as a huge kind of behemoth or huge industry as well are kind of going down and kind of meeting the zine culture in kind of some ways as well. Because I think that that whole paradigm of magazines being these huge kind of monoliths that can reach kind of hundreds of thousands of people isn't really working in this kind of culture where everyone's interests are so much more niche. So it's kind of fun that you can also have kind of more resource magazines lower their expectations and kind of go use kind of the zine thinking to kind of reach kind of smaller and more kind of focused audiences. And I think that just makes for better content and it's a better kind of experience. But I think Melbourne especially has a really rich zine culture. And that's kind of something I've always noticed kind of since moving here.
Sticky Institute.
Sticky Institute.
Yeah.
Like we'll put a link to that. So anyone who's not from Melbourne or Australia, it's like it's a full shop and kind of school as well that's kind of focused on zines. And I don't know if they're actually, I feel embarrassed saying this because I'm not sure if kind of they're still around because there was a whole redevelopment of the subway that they're under, but
yeah,
we'll do some research there.
I think they are. I'm fairly sure that they are, but I think they did, yeah, they sort of were part of that redevelopment. But I mean, that place has been there forever and I'm always seeing friends in my sort of periphery that are like going to do, whether it's like, I don't know, workshops or they're printing their own stuff there or they're sending things, they're promoting that they're sending things there. But I've never, ever been a part of that world. It's a bit of a mystery to me, John.
Well, it's interesting because Isnot magazine as well, which was the kind of the impetus that started Jackie Winter, was a zine as well. And we want to talk about distribution. Like that was just a zine that was kind of put on bill poster sites, you know, so people could kind of read it in public. So yeah, zines very close to me. But John, I'm just curious as well with your own zine and how that kind of fits into your practice. Like why do you kind of continue publishing on Medium? Like why isn't everything just kind of a zine? How do you kind of balance those two parts of your practice out?
So I guess I do the blog for other people and I do the zine for myself. I was sitting at a bar not so long ago here in Sydney having a few drinks with a friend of mine who works in BC. And I said that I was getting less joy out of writing the blog and I was thinking of winding the blog down. And she said, well, actually, I don't want you to do that because you write about things like loneliness that has been useful to me over the past few years and I don't want to see you stop that. And I stopped doing that. And so while I was getting less pleasure from it, I could see that I was being able to write about some things that needed to be written about. And I guess in startups, there's a lot of bullshit out there. And if you do have a blog that has a bit of reach, you'll have something. If your blog has a bit of reach that can kind of push back against that, then publishing it is a good thing to do. So I'm still doing it. I'm still writing it. And people enjoy it and they get something out of it. But at the same time, I need to write in a way that gives me joy. And for me, that's what the zine actually is. It's a degree of publishing that is so deeply personal that I can feel like I'm truly expressing my creativity. And I'm doing so without any analytics. That's kind of a big part. So the blog, I can see who's read and for how long and all this kind of information that I guess I don't need to see. But with a zine, all I have is how many people downloaded it. I don't even have Google Analytics installed on the actual website for the zine because I don't want to know all that information or that marketing crap. I just want to have something that is purely created as an expression of my interests and my creativity.
It makes me wonder, though, if kind of this whole, I think the idea of serendipity as this kind of thing that is missing in our culture and the thing that's kind of something that zines kind of give you, I almost kind of wonder, is that something that can actually be sustained or is that going to last? Like, how long is it before someone makes the zine kind of, it's like you make your own zine in this kind of app and then you could track where other people are kind of where to buy and kind of sell zines and everything. Like, it seems like it's so ripe to get kind of wrapped up in all that. John, where do you kind of see that kind of zine culture is kind of going in this resurgence and how can it kind of fit in with this digital culture? I mean, so much of what we're hearing now in terms of younger people communicating is all about kind of going offline and kind of using these kind of much more kind of niche channels like to communicate with each other. I feel like such an old person.
Yeah, you are talking about the youth.
All this stuff now, but I'm curious, where do you think this kind of goes from here?
I mean, I have a few different perspectives on that. To begin with, whenever we have a commercialization of youth culture or counterculture or underground culture, the culture either responds by disappearing or by going more extreme, sometimes both. So, you have punk rock and punk rock comes along and the Sex Pistols go pretty mainstream and everyone's listening to them and people are dancing down in the UK at their weddings and things like that. And in response, punk goes incredibly extreme. You have the Dead Kennedys, you have bands like Crass who live together in communes and literally aim to bring down the government. So it goes to that kind of extreme. And then you see it again in the 90s with the early internet denizens who were sharing, I guess, resources to live off the grid. And once the internet went kind of mainstream, they went even more extreme and started hiding away on message boards that people couldn't find. So I guess my prediction is that if zines do get co-opted and zines do get turned into an app by some white, straight, male Stanford graduate who thinks he can make $1 billion out of selling the same thing that people give away for free, then people will probably respond by having a more extreme version of that expression, whether it's by painting a zine on a wall somewhere and making it so many people can actually read it if they find it physically wherever it is, or it will just become completely mainstream and then disappear.
That's such an interesting point, because I imagine, I mean, whenever there's a commercialization of something, I guess part of that community get absorbed into it and part of that community, as you said, go more extreme.
Absolutely, yeah. We are cyclical by nature. No matter what happens, we walk away from fads and then we go back to them, whether it's flared trousers or Black Flag or anything else. You know, it'll come around again in the cycle. So if zines do explode somewhere and some dude named Chad makes a bunch of money off it, then eventually that will die out.
They're all called Chad.
or Craig or something like that.
I did want to ask you, just to wrap up here, I mean, you posed a question to us in your notes, that a quote from Marshall McLuhan that if the medium is the message. And so you're asking the medium of the zine, whether it's physical or it's digital like your one, what is that message? And I think that was an interesting point. Firstly, I did have to go and read about the quote, because there are some very confusing interpretations of the quote. And there are lots and lots of articles, including a full like Wikipedia page, trying to break down what he meant in that in that quote. But I think one thing that I would say is that you can argue that the message is definitely one of freedom of speech and independence. I think regardless of the content, the zine medium does make a sort of inherent statement about its separation from commercial corporate systems. I think even if the content isn't spicy, there's a baked-in sentiment there because of the history and the nature of their creation, because they're self-published and they're self-funded. And I think depending on who you ask, to some people that further legitimizes the messaging of the content because it's independent, and to others that sort of marginalizes it, in the same way that, you know, I think about like the parents of my writer friends are really excited when their kid gets published in print, but not so much when they get published online, even though these days there's often far more of a budget and a readership for online work than printed. And I think there is definitely a unique freedom that comes with any media that isn't commercialized. You know, in many ways, being unable to make money from it also means that you have far more free reign to do, say, make, produce whatever you want, which again is often the real appeal with things like zines and podcasts. It's very similar, really. Like the materials needed to make one are so cheap and so accessible, and you don't need permission to do it. And it's something you can do as a one-man band, just like zines. And that, of course, breeds this enormous variety in the output and kind of levels the playing field somewhat, because the different types of content and the people creating them, it's more of a meritocracy where the best content stands out. But at the same time, it is still a niche, sort of small, semi-marginalized thing that a lot of people might not take seriously. And I wonder, like, how do you feel about that? Do you think that that message of the medium is an issue or a positive?
I think there's a difference between the content and the container for the content. So if you look at a website like Inc.com or a publication like Time Magazine, those containers are valuable in and of themselves. And so we populate them with content, and we provide content based on the value that we see that container has. And that container's value could be based on brand or on legacy or anything like that. Whereas with a zine, there is no distinction between content and container. It's not, a zine isn't a magazine with a collection of articles. Sure, there are articles inside it, but the zine itself as a whole is the content. There is no distinction there. And so I think it kind of comes down to, why do we assign value to content versus containers? You know, if your parent is more excited that you've been published in print than online, they don't actually give a flying fuck about your content. All they care about is the container. And so I think that kind of speaks to it. And I guess it almost self-filters. So if you have somebody who doesn't understand that content has a value divorced from the container, then you are filtering out people who don't really understand the value of content in the first place, or who have a shallow understanding of what that creativity is.
Very amazing insight, John. And if people want to find out more like about your zine, is there a place that do you have to go somewhere mysterious to find it?
You can actually go to www.adriftzine.com.
Amazing.
And we will post a link to that with our show notes.
Fantastic. Thanks for this link, John.
All good.
It is time for drum roll, please. We need a drum if we're going to keep doing this thing.
No, I like our self-published, self-funded drum roll.
The brilliantly named thumbs up, thumbs down, Shaka. We're locking in Shaka.
The third option. I'm into it.
Okay,
yeah.
Excellent. The time we dedicate each week to get the good, bad, and the complete. Is the Shaka the completely petty?
No, the Shaka's the like, yeah, sick, cool, cheers.
Just in its own thing. Okay. Yeah. Off our chest. Why? Because we like to. That's what we do every week. We need to adjust this language because the script says because no one will listen to us. But people will listen to us. They want to listen to us. I listen to you.
Do you reckon people have skipped on to like This American Life by this point of the show? They've skipped on to their next episode.
Part.
It is the best part.
John, we were hinting at the MailChimp rebrand as something that you might want to get off your chest. But do you have something else that you'd like to maybe supersede in an endorsement or a complaint?
Oh, look, I'm constantly angry about the state of the world and the McDonald's menu that doesn't have McRib and Scott Morrison and all his policies. But I guess
as it should
really
be.
Keeps me up at night is the fact that applications keep on changing their user experience and the user interface without warning people, so that you wake up one morning with an absolute culture shock. And I really hate it. And it's actually quite distressing. Like, if you're someone like me, you really get used to certain things. You don't necessarily like a lot of change because it leads to instability. And so to wake up my morning to finish off a newsletter that you were working on the day before and have the entire interface look different is incredibly jarring.
I totally get it. I'm just like even on an even smaller level when companies change their logo, and because on my phone, I'm so used to like my brain just looks for the color or the like the general shape of the icon. And when like I constantly choose, I think there's like, it's like Gumtree and Groupon or something, or like Menu Log and Groupon or something look the same. And I'm constantly choosing the wrong one. Yeah. And it drives me mad.
Laura, is that your thumbs down or do you have something else?
No, I have a thumbs up. I'm positive vibes today. Mine is, so Sheena and Mel here in the office, they have a real love for lemon tea. They've been, off the website iHerb, they've been slowly ordering like every kind of lemon tea that exists. And they found this one that's called I Love Lemon Tea. And I swear it's the best tea you'll ever have. And it's like a few bucks off iHerb, my favorite weird website.
Oh, iHerb is the best.
iHerb is the best. You can buy like lots of weird plant-based proteins. It's very strange and like hair vitamins. but it's very, very good. I love lemon tea. And I think they sell it in like Whole Foods in the US or something. So it's like actually a thing in other places. But here, it's nowhere. And it's very, very good. And the girls just bought me a box of it the other day. So I'm very happy.
Lovely.
Good work. I am going to go full on Shaka this week. Yeah.
Cowabunga.
This is, you know, what I've realized, this segment is really for me to get like my kind of B links out, because I always have too many links that I can fit.
I know. And I yelled at you too much for having too many links in the one show.
But guess what? I'm the boss. I can decide whatever the fuck goes in this podcast.
Unfortunately, that's the case.
Now, this is a website for a exhibition called Gallery. The website is gallery.delivery, and it's your favorite artist delivered. And it was an amazing kind of show that was in Berlin for around 2 weeks in late September. And the whole concept was that, you know, you could kind of order any kind of food or anything else, kind of be on demand. Why can't you do with art? So basically, you enter your address, pick a time slot, pay 15 euros, and then they deliver the exhibition to your home, where it will be set up for you. So a courier comes with like one of those Deliveroo, Uber Eats kind of bags, but inside there are 20 pieces of art. He sets up the exhibition in your space.
For how long?
In the FAQ, it doesn't say. I think it's like a few hours. But basically, you can invite people over. There's pieces of the work that are kind of for sale. It's such an amazing work. So yeah,
I love that. Wow,
it's a fantastic idea. It's one
cool
of the
cool website. Like, I'm looking at it now.
Yeah, it's a great website. So it was only done in Berlin. In the end of September. But a fantastic idea. I think it's something that could easily be kind of open sourced and kind of done by other people. So this could be an amazing kind of plug into the kind of zine culture. And I love this whole idea of just kind of using the medium of kind of delivery and on demand kind of driver and things and completely subverting
this time next week. Your thumbs up is going to be the Jackie Winter delivery gallery.
No, I'm putting, like, we have enough new things in the pipeline to keep us busy for a bit longer. So I think that will do us for now. John, thank you so much. If people want to find out more about you, not just your zine, but anything else, John Westenberg, where can they do that?
They can go to johnwestenberg.com, or they can follow me on Twitter at John Westenberg, or they can go down to a cafe called York Lane where I drink most nights and write on the walls with Sharpies and hang out with the bartender Dieter, who loves me dearly. Good friend of mine.
Do they know that you're writing on the walls? Are we going to be getting you some sort of criminal conviction by releasing this on the podcast?
No, whenever I come in, Dieter gives me a Sharpie and says, write something.
Oh, it's demanded. Yeah.
Eventually, that's good. I like actually that. Write an entire zine on the wall of his cafe and then take photos of it and then publish that on paper. But I haven't
that's
done
very
that yet.
Good. Speaking of, I've just subscribed to your zine and I'm very excited. Thank you so, so much, John.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Beth. It's only half of it.
Okay, so to wrap things up, we're going to give this one more shot. I think we've been doing for the last 4 weeks, I've been doing speed runs of our outro, and I've agreed that if I can't continually break the record, I will stop. But I kind of think the more I do it, the more I'm kind of getting into a flow. So I feel really good about this week. Laura, what's the time to beat?
Yeah. The time to beat is 48 seconds, 79 milliseconds. I, again, just to be the voice of reason here, I appreciate you doing your warm-ups, Jeremy. No one can understand the outro information anymore.
Yeah. Don't care.
What's the point of having an outro? Okay.
I'm doing it. Count me in.
Jeremy doesn't care. I'm going to count you in. Let me get my timer up and ready. All righty, Jeremy. 3, 2, 1.
I'm Jeremy Wards and she's Laura Chan Bacon. This is Jackie Winter. Gives you the business. Our theme music by totally unrelated our company, Melbourne based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out the stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more Jackie Winter, gives you the business. Archives of all the shows and links can be found at jackiewinter.com.gz to receive all links we talk about on the show each week. In one neat little package, you can sign to our podcast newsletter, timeline.com/Jackie Winter. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with the Y. Winter like the season. You can hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing, rating, and leaving us a comment on iTunes. And of course, recommending us to all your mates as well as iTunes. They can get the show wherever you get podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher, or for the traditionalist directly from our website, JackieWinter.com.gz. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you're listening to this podcast, Overcast or Castro, you'll be able to see the links in the articles that we're talking about. As well as other Schmick visual content as we're around. It's like we're right there in the room with you. And if you work in advertising, agency, design, so you're interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out our opentabs.radio for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye bye.
For fuck's sake, you beat it again.
What I get?
Just. So the time to beat was 48.79. You got 48.15.
See, I'm getting to a flow. I've got a new method.
Your trick is just monotone.
No.
Well, your trick is just have no sort of intonation.
That's the thing. I have to be in the zone, but I'm also trying to figure out how I can talk going in. You know, if I can get it both voices, you know, like that Tenacious D song, Inward Singing. It's exactly like that.
You could be like a Buddhist sort of monk doing the
exactly. circular breathing. There you go.
This is an issue. All right.
Okay. Well, in case you missed it, you can find everything you need at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Write us with anything at podcast@jackiewinter.com. We're going to have our last show of the season next week before we break again. So really keen to get some feedback on things that you would like to have covered, any guests you'd like to hear from, anything
just
else.
Just praise for Laura. That's good too.
Anyway, we will see you next week. Thanks for listening. Bye bye. But most people, I repeated
what have
something.
You done?
Sorry.
Sorry, John.
Okay, my John.
It's very hot in our tiny room and makes us get a bit loopy as soon as we get to 10 minutes. Yeah. Rose thing is like, hey, this padding and noise insulation is great, but it makes you really, really hot.